which is useless to me, and of which I understand nothing, which even those who have devoted themselves to it during their youth are obliged to give up at the age when I want to begin it. At that time it would have been in its right place. The opportunity was favourable, and I had some temptation to make use of it. The satisfaction that I saw in Anet's eyes when he came home loaded with new plants, two or three times nearly made me go out botanizing with him. I'm almost certain that if I had only gone once, I should have been captivated by it, and I should, perhaps, now be a famous botanist, for I know no study in the world better suited to my natural tastes than that of plants, and the life which I have now been leading for 10 years in the country is hardly anything but a continual botanizing, although certainly without purpose or progress. But at that time, having no idea of the science of botany, I conceived a kind of contempt, even of aversion, for it, and only considered it an occupation fit for an apothecary. Mamma, who was very fond of it, made no other use of it herself. She only looked for common plants, such as she could make use of in her remedies. In this manner, botany, chemistry, and anatomy, confused in my mind under the general term medicine, only served to provide me throughout the day with a subject for humorous sarcasms, and from time to time brought upon me a box on the ears. Besides, a different and most opposite taste gradually developed itself in me, and soon supplanted all the others. I mean music. I must certainly have been born for this art, since I began to love it from my earliest childhood, and it is the only one that I have loved constantly at all times. The remarkable thing is that an art, for which I was intended by nature, has nevertheless cost me so much trouble to learn, and that my progress in it has been so slow, that, although I have practiced it all my life, I have never been able to sing with any certainty at sight. What at that time made this study particularly a pleasure was that I could pursue it together with Mamma. With very different tastes in other respects, we found in music a bond of union, which I gladly made use of. She made no objection. I was at that time almost as advanced as she was. After two or three attempts, we could decipher an air. Sometimes, when I saw her busy round a furnace, I used to say, "Mamma, here is a charming duet which seems to me just the thing to make your drugs smell of burning." "On my honour," she would reply, "if you make me burn them, I will make you eat them." While the dispute was going on, I pulled her to her piano, where we soon forgot everything else. The extract of juniper or absinthe was reduced to powder. She smeared my face with it, and how delightful it all was. It will be seen that, with little time to spare, I had many things to employ it. One amusement, however, was worth all the rest. We lived in a dungeon so stifling that we were sometimes obliged to go and get some fresh air in the country. Anet persuaded Mamma to rent a garden in one of the suburbs to rear plants. Attached to this garden was a pretty little rustic house, which was decently furnished, and a bed put up in it. We often had dinner, and I sometimes slept there. Imperceptibly I became infatuated with this little retreat. I took a few books there and a number of prints. I spent part of my time in decorating it and preparing an agreeable surprise for Mamma when she walked out there. I sometimes left her that I might busy my mind with her and think of her with greater pleasure. This was another whim, which I can neither excuse nor explain, but which I acknowledge, since it was really the case. I remember that Madame de Luxembourg once spoke jestingly to me of a man who used to leave his mistress in order to write to her. I told her that I might very well have been that man, and I might have added that I'd sometimes acted like him. However, when I was with Mamma, I never felt it necessary to leave her in order to love her more, for, tête-à-tête with her, I felt as completely at my ease as if I'd been alone, which I have never felt in the presence of anyone else, man or woman, however much attached to them I may have been. But she was so often surrounded by people, who were by no means congenial to me, that a feeling of annoyance and weariness drove me to my refuge, where I could enjoy her as I wanted her, without fear of being followed by troublesome visitors. In this manner, my time being divided between work, pleasure, and instruction, I led a life of sweetest repose. Europe, however, was not so calm as myself. France and the Emperor had just declared war, the King of Sardinia had taken part in the quarrel, and the French army was marching through Piedmont to invade Milanese territory. One column passed through Chambéry, amongst others the regiment of Champagne, the colonel of which was the Duc de la Trémouille, to whom I was presented. He was lavish in his promises, and I am quite certain that he never once thought of me again. Our little garden was situated just at the end of the suburb through which the troops entered, so that I could enjoy to my heart's content the pleasure of seeing them pass, and I was as eager for the success of this war as if I had had the greatest interests at stake in it. Hitherto it had not entered my head to think about public affairs, and I began to read the newspapers for the first time, but with such partiality for France that my heart beat with joy when it gained the least success, while its reverses afflicted me as much as if they had overtaken myself. If this folly had only been transitory, I should not consider it worth speaking of, but it has become so rooted in my heart, without any sufficient reason, that when, later, at Paris, I played the part of the enemy of tyrants and the proud republican, I felt, in spite of myself, a secret predilection for this very nation I found servile, and for the government which I pretended to condemn. The amusing thing was that, being ashamed of an inclination so opposed to my principles, I never dared to confess it to anyone, and I rallied the French on their defeats, while my heart bled for them more than their own. I am certainly the only man who, living in the midst of a people who treated him well and whom he worshipped, has assumed amongst them an air of contempt. On my part, this inclination is so disinterested, so powerful, so lasting, and so invincible, that even after my departure from France, after the storm which its government, magistrates, and writers have vied with one another in stirring up against me, and since it has become the fashion to overwhelm me with undeserved abuse, I have been unable to cure myself of my folly. I love them in spite of myself, in spite of their ill treatment of me. I have long endeavoured to discover the reason of this partiality, and have been unable to find it anywhere except in the occasion that produced it. A growing taste for literature gave me a fondness for French books, their authors, and the country of these authors. At the moment when the French army was marching past, I read Brantôme's Great Captains. My head was full of the Clissons, Bayards, Lautrecs, Colignys, Montmorencys, and Trémouilles, and I loved their descendants as the inheritors of their virtues and their courage. In each regiment that passed, I thought I beheld again those famous black bands which had formerly performed such heroic deeds in Piedmont. In short, I connected with what I saw the ideas which I drew from my books. My continuous reading, still confined to French authors, nourished my affection for their country, and finally converted it into a blind infatuation, which nothing has been able to overcome. I have later had occasion to remark in the course of my journeys that this impression was not peculiar to myself, and that, exercising more or less influence in all countries upon that part of the nation which loves reading and cultivates literature, it counterbalanced the general hatred inspired by the conceited manners of the French. Their romances, more than their men, win the hearts of the women of all countries. Their dramatic masterpieces attract the young to their theatres. The fame of the theatres of Paris draws crowds of strangers, who return home their enthusiastic admirers. In short, the excellent taste displayed in their literature captivates the minds of all those who have any mind, and during the war which ended so disastrously for them, I have seen their authors and philosophers uphold the honour of the French name, so tarnished by its warriors. I was, then, an ardent Frenchman, and this made me a newsmonger. I went with a crowd of gapers to the marketplace to wait for the post. And, sillier than the ass in the fable, I was very anxious to know what master's saddle I should have the honour to carry. For at that time it was declared that we should belong to France, and that Savoy would be exchanged for the territory of Milan. However, it must be admitted that I had some reason for anxiety, for if this war had turned out badly for the Allies, Mama's pension would have been in danger. But I had full confidence in my good friends, and this time, in spite of the surprise of Monsieur de Broglie, my confidence was not deceived, thanks to the King of Sardinia, whom I had never thought of. While there was fighting in Italy, there was singing in France. Rameau's operas began to make a stir, and gave a lift to his theoretical works, which, by reason of their obscurity, were within the reach of only a few capacities. Having accidentally heard his Treatise on Harmony mentioned, I had no rest till I had procured the book. By another accident I fell ill. The malady was an inflammation, which was very violent during the short time it lasted, but my restoration to health was tedious, and I was unable to go out for a month. During this period I worked at, I devoured my Treatise on Harmony, but it was so long, so diffuse, and so badly arranged, that I felt it would take me a considerable time to study and disentangle it. I suspended my efforts, and refreshed my eyes with music. The cantatas of Bernier, which I practised, were never out of my mind. I learned four or five of them by heart, amongst others the Sleeping Cupids, which I have never seen again since then, and which I still remember almost perfectly, and also Cupid Stung by a Bee, a very pretty cantata by Clérambault, which I learned almost at the same time. To confirm my passion, a young organist called the Abbé Palais arrived from Val d'Aoste, a good musician, a good fellow, and an excellent accompanist. I made his acquaintance, and we immediately became inseparable. He had been the pupil of an Italian monk, a fine organist. He spoke to me of his principles of music, which I compared with those of my Rameau. I filled my head with harmony, accompaniments, and chords. My ear required training for all that, and I proposed to Mama to give a little concert every month, to which she agreed. I was so full of this concert that day and night I thought of nothing else, and it really occupied a considerable part of my time to arrange the music, the accompanists and instruments, to write out the parts and so forth. Mama sang, Père Caton, of whom I have already spoken, and of whom I shall have occasion to speak again, sang also. Monsieur Roche, a dancing master, and his son, played the violin. Monsieur Canava, a Piedmontese musician, who was employed in the survey and has since married and settled at Paris, played the violoncello. The Abbé Palais accompanied on the piano, and I had the honour of conducting with my baton. It may be imagined how delightful it was, not quite like the concerts at Monsieur de Tretorin's, but nearly so. This little concert given by Madame de Warennes, a new convert, who lived, as was reported on the King's charity, gave offence to the band of devotees, but for many worthy people it was an agreeable amusement. It would not easily be guessed whom I placed at the head of these on this occasion. It was a monk, but a monk, talented and even amiable, whose later misfortunes keenly affected me, and whose memory, connected as it is with that of my happy days, is still dear to me. The monk in question was Père Caton, a Franciscan who, conjointly with Comte d'Autun, had caused the music of the poor kitten to be confiscated at Lyon, which was not the most worthy incident in his life. He was a bachelor of Sorbonne. He had lived a long time in the highest circles in Paris, and was an especial favourite of the Marquis d'Entremont, at that time Sardinian ambassador. He was tall, well-built, with a full face and prominent eyes, black hair which curled naturally over his forehead, and a manner at once noble, frank, and modest. His appearance was simple and pleasing, without the hypocritical or impudent attitude of a monk, or the haughty demeanour of a man of fashion. Although he was one, he displayed only the assurance of an honourable man, who, without blushing for his cloth, respects himself and always feels himself in his proper place in honourable company. Although he was not very learned for a doctor, he was very accomplished for a man of the world, and, never eager to display his knowledge, he made use of it so opportunely that he was credited with more than he really possessed. Having lived much in society, he had paid more attention to agreeable accomplishments than to solid learning. He was witty, wrote verses, talked well, sang better, had a fine voice and played the organ and piano. This was more than enough to make him sought after, as indeed he was. But so little did this cause him to neglect the duties of his position, that in spite of jealous rivals, he was chosen définiteur of his province, in other words, one of the highest dignitaries of the order. Définiteur is an assessor to the head of his order. Père Caton made Mamma's acquaintance at the Marquis d'Entremont's. He heard our concerts spoken of and expressed a desire to take part in them. He did so, and made them delightful. We soon became attached by our mutual taste for music, which, with both of us, was a lively passion, the only difference being that he was really a musician, while I was only a bungler. We used to go and play in his room together with Canova and the Abbé Palais, and sometimes on feast days we had music on his organ. We often shared his little table at dinner, for, a thing surprising in a monk, he was liberal, profuse, and fond of the pleasures of the table, without being a glutton. On our concert days, he stayed to supper with Mamma. These suppers were very gay and very pleasant. We spoke, as we thought, and sang duets. I was in my element, and displayed my wit and humour. Père Caton was delightful. Mamma was adorable. The Abbé Palais, with his deep voice, was the butt of all. Sweet moments of youthful folly, how long it is since you have departed. As I shall have no further occasion to speak of this poor Père Caton, let me finish his melancholy story in a few words. The other monks, jealous or rather furious at seeing in him good qualities and a refinement of manners which had nothing in common with monastic debauchery, conceived a violent hatred for him, since he was not as hateful as themselves. Their leaders combined against him and stirred up the inferior monks who envied his position, and who had hitherto not dared to look at him. They heaped 1,000 insults upon him, deprived him of his office, took away his room, which he had furnished with taste, although quite simply, and banished him I know not whither. At last, these wretches so overwhelmed him with insults that his honourable and justly proud soul was unable to withstand them, and he who had been the delight of the most agreeable society died of grief on a miserable bed in some cell or dungeon, regretted and lamented by all the worthy people who had known him, and found no other fault in him except that of being a monk. Living in this manner, I soon became entirely absorbed by music, and found it impossible to think of anything else. I never went to my desk willingly. The restraint and constant hard work made it an unendurable torture, and at last I expressed a wish to throw up my employment in order to devote myself entirely to music. It may be imagined that this folly on my part did not escape opposition. To leave a respectable situation and a certain salary in order to run after uncertain pupils was too foolish a plan to meet with Mamma's approval. Even if my future success should prove as great as I imagined, it was fixing very humble limits to my ambition to confine myself for life to the position of a musician. She, whose plans for me were all ambitious, and who no longer judged me entirely in accordance with Monsieur d'Aubon's verdict, was sorry to see me seriously occupied with a talent which she regarded as unprofitable, and often repeated to me the provincial saying, which is less applicable in Paris, "He who sings and dances well has a profession which does not lead to much." On the other hand, she saw me carried away by an irresistible inclination. My passion for music was becoming a regular madness, and there was reason to fear that my work might suffer from my distractions, and that this might cause me to be dismissed, which would be far worse than voluntary resignation. Again, I pointed out to her that my employment was only temporary, that I should be obliged to do something for a livelihood, and that it was far safer to acquire by practice a thorough knowledge of the art to which my tastes inclined me, and which she had chosen for me, than to put myself at the mercy of patrons, or to try something fresh which might not succeed, and might leave me, when I was too old to learn, without the means of earning my bread. At last, I extorted her consent, more by dint of importunities and caresses than arguments which she considered satisfactory. I immediately ran to Monsieur Coccelli, general manager of the survey, to resign my appointment, as proudly as if I'd performed a most heroic action. And I voluntarily resigned my situation, without cause, reason, or excuse, with as much and even greater joy than I had accepted it less than 2 years before. This step, utterly foolish as it was, procured for me in the country a certain consideration which was useful to me. Some imagined that I possessed means which I did not possess. Others, seeing me entirely devoted to music, estimated my talents by the sacrifice that I had made, and believed that, with so much passion for this art, I must really possess a superior knowledge of it. In the country of the blind, the one-eyed are kings. I passed for a good master, since all the rest were bad. Besides, since I really possessed a certain taste for singing, and was also favoured by my age and personal appearance, I soon had more lady pupils than were necessary to make up the pay I had received as a clerk. It is certain that, as far as a pleasant life was concerned, it would not have been possible for anyone to pass more rapidly from one extreme to the other. At the survey, occupied for 8 hours daily with the most disagreeable employment, amongst people still more disagreeable, shut up in a gloomy office, poisoned by the breath and perspiration of a number of clods, most of them dirty and unkempt, I was sometimes so overcome by the exertion, smell, restraint, and weariness, that I felt quite giddy. In place of this, I was suddenly launched into the fashionable world, admitted and sought after in the best houses, everywhere graciously received, caressed, and fêted. Amiable young ladies, gaily dressed, awaited my arrival and received me with eagerness. I saw nothing but enchanting objects. I smelt nothing but the perfume of roses and orange flowers, found nothing but singing, gossip, laughter, and amusement. I only left one house to find the same in another. It will be agreed that, the other advantages being equal, there could be no hesitation in the choice. I was so satisfied with mine that I never once repented it, and I do not regret it even now, when I weigh in the scale of reason the actions of my life, and am free from the not very sensible motives which led me to make it. This was almost the only time that I was not deceived in my expectations, when I only obeyed my inclinations. The affable and social disposition, the easy-going temperament of the inhabitants of this country rendered my intercourse with the world agreeable, and the liking I then conceived for it has clearly proved to me that if I do not like society, it is society's fault rather than mine. It is to be regretted that the Savoyards are not rich, or perhaps it would still be more to be regretted if they were, for, such as they are the best and most sociable people that I know. If there is a little city in the world where it is possible to enjoy the pleasures of life in agreeable and safe intercourse, it is Chambéry. The noble families of the province, who assemble there, have only enough to live on, not enough to advance themselves, and being unable to indulge in ambitious projects, are obliged to follow the counsel of Cineas, the minister of Pyrrhus, king of Epirus. In youth, they devote themselves to military service, and return to spend their old age in peace at home. Honour and reason have an equal share in this distribution of their lives. The women are beautiful, without having any need to be so. They possess all those qualities which can give beauty its value, and even supply its place. It is remarkable that I, whose profession brought me into contact with so many young girls, do not remember to have ever seen one in Chambéry who was not charming. It will be said that I was inclined to find them so, and there may be some truth in that. But I had no need to add anything of my own. In truth, I cannot think of my young pupils without pleasure. Why, when I mention here the most amiable of them, can I not reinstate them and myself together in those happy times which we then enjoyed, those sweet and innocent moments which we spent together? The first was Mademoiselle de Mellarede, my neighbour, the sister of Monsieur Game's pupil. She was a lively brunette, full of tender vivacity and grace, and free from thoughtlessness. Like most girls of her age, she was rather thin, but her bright eyes, her slender figure, and her attractive manner needed no fullness to add to her charm. I used to go to her in the morning, when she was generally in déshabille, without any headdress except her hair, carelessly pinned up and set off by a few flowers which she placed there on my arrival, and which were taken off when I left, for her hair to be dressed. I am more afraid of a pretty young woman in déshabille than of anything else in the world. I should fear them 100 times less in full dress, as Mademoiselle de Montan, to whose house I went in the afternoon, always was. She made upon me an equally pleasing but entirely different impression. Her hair was very light. She was very slight, very shy, and very fair. Her voice was clear, correct, and melodious, but she was afraid of employing its full compass. She had a scar on her bosom where she'd been scalded by some boiling water, which was only partly hidden by a neckerchief of blue chenille. This mark sometimes drew my attention to the place, and in a short time no longer on account of the scar. Mademoiselle de Chasles, another of my neighbours, was fully developed, tall, well-made, and rather stout. She had been very pretty, but was no longer a beauty. But she deserves notice on account of her graceful manners, even temper, and good disposition. Her sister, Madame de Chalis, the prettiest woman in Chambéry, no longer learned music, but I gave lessons to her daughter, who was still quite young, and whose growing beauty gave promise of equalling that of her mother, had she not unfortunately been somewhat red-haired. At the convent of the Visitation I gave lessons to a young French lady, whose name I have forgotten, but who deserves a place in the list of my favourite pupils. She had adopted the slow and drawling tones of the nuns, and in this drawling tone made some very witty remarks, which seemed quite out of harmony with her manner. For the rest, she was idle, not caring to take pains to show her wit, which was a favour she did not grant to everyone. It was only after a month or two, during which I had given her lessons and she'd been very idle, that she bethought herself of this expedient to make me more punctual, a thing which I have never been able to persuade myself to be. I liked my lessons while I was giving them, but I did not like the idea of being obliged to attend or being tied to time. Restraint and subjection of any kind are to me at all times unbearable. They would make me hate even pleasure itself. It is said that, amongst the Mohammedans, a man goes through the streets at daybreak, ordering husbands to do their duty to their wives. I should be a poor Turk at that hour. I also had some pupils among the middle classes, amongst others, one who was the indirect cause of a change in my relations, of which I have to speak, since I must tell everything. She was a grocer's daughter, named Mademoiselle Lard, a perfect model for a Greek statue, and whom I should quote as the most beautiful girl I've ever seen, if true beauty could exist without life and soul. Her indifference, coldness, and want of feeling were almost incredible. It was as impossible to please as it was to annoy her, and I am convinced that if any man had made an attempt upon her virtue, she would have allowed him to succeed, not from inclination, but from sheer stupidity. Her mother, who did not wish to run the risk, never left her for a moment. In having her taught singing, in providing her with a young master, she did all she could to rouse her, but without success. While the master tried to fascinate the daughter, the mother tried to fascinate the master, with equally bad success. Madame Lard united with her natural vivacity all the sprightliness which her daughter should have possessed. She was a lively, pretty little woman, although her features were somewhat irregular and marked with the smallpox. She had small, fiery eyes, which were rather red, and nearly always sore. Every morning, on my arrival, I found my coffee and cream ready. The mother never failed to salute me with a hearty kiss on the lips, which I should have liked to return to the daughter, merely out of curiosity to see how she would have taken it. All this was done so simply and naturally that, even when Monsieur Lard was there, the kissing and caressing went on as usual. He was a good fellow, the true father of his daughter, whom his wife never deceived, since she had no need to do so. I submitted to all these caresses with my usual stupidity, treating them simply as tokens of friendship. Sometimes they became troublesome, for lively Madame Lard always exacted her rights, and if in the course of the day I had passed the shop without stopping, it would have created a disturbance. When I was in a hurry, I was obliged to go round by another street, for I well knew that it was not so easy a matter to get out of her house as to enter it. Madame Lard showed me too much attention for me to show none to her. These attentions touched me greatly. I spoke about them to Mama, as something which was no secret. And even if there had been any mystery, I should have spoken to her all the same, for it would have been impossible for me to keep a secret of any kind from her. My heart was as open before her as in the sight of heaven. She did not consider the matter quite as harmless as I did. She saw advances where I had only seen friendship. She thought that if Madame Lard made it a point of honour not to leave me as great a fool as she had found me, she would somehow or other succeed in making herself understood, and apart from the consideration that it was not fair that another woman should undertake the instruction of her pupil, she had motives which were more worthy of her, in a desire to protect me from the snares to which my age and calling exposed me. At the same time, a more dangerous snare was set for me, which I indeed escaped, but which showed her that the dangers, which continually threatened me, rendered necessary all the measures of protection which she could employ. The Comtesse de Menthon, the mother of one of my pupils, was a woman of great wit, and had the reputation of being equally malicious. It was reported that she had caused several quarrels, amongst others, one which had fatal consequences for the house of Entremont. Mama was sufficiently intimate with her to be acquainted with her character, having quite innocently taken the fancy of someone upon whom Madame de Menthon had designs. Mama was charged by her with the offence of the preference shown towards her, although she had neither sought nor accepted it. And from that time Madame de Menthon sought to do her rival several ill turns, none of which succeeded. By way of sample, I will relate one of the most laughable. They were together in the country, with several gentlemen of the neighbourhood, amongst whom was the suitor in question. Madame de Menthon one day told one of these gentlemen that Madame de Varennes was very affected, and she had no taste, dressed badly, and kept her bosom covered like a tradesman's wife. "As for the last point," answered the gentleman, who was fond of a joke, "she has her reasons for it. I know she has a scar on her breast, just like an ugly rat, so perfectly natural that it looks as if it was moving." Hatred, like love, causes credulity. Madame de Menthon resolved to make capital out of this discovery. And one day, when Mama was playing cards with the lady's ungrateful favourite, She seized the opportunity to step behind her rival, and, almost upsetting her chair, cleverly turned back her neckerchief. But instead of the large rat, the gentleman saw something very different, which it was easier to see than to forget. And this was certainly not what the lady had intended. I was not calculated to attract Madame de Menthon, who only liked to see brilliant company around her. Nevertheless, she paid me some attention, not on account of my personal appearance, about which she certainly did not trouble herself, but because of my supposed wit, which might have made me serviceable to her. She had a lively taste for satire, and was fond of composing songs and verses upon those who displeased her. If she had found me sufficiently gifted to assist her in composing her verses, and sufficiently obliging to write them, between us we should soon have turned Champéry upside down. These lampoons would have been traced back to their source. Madame de Menthon would have got out of it by sacrificing me, and I should perhaps have been imprisoned for the rest of my life, as a reward for playing the Apollo of the ladies. Happily, nothing of the kind happened. Madame de Menthon kept me to dinner two or three times to make me talk, and found that I was only a fool. I was conscious of this myself, and sighed over it, envying the accomplishments of my friend Venture, whereas I ought to have been grateful to my stupidity for saving me from danger. I continued her daughter's singing master, and nothing more. But I lived peacefully, and was always welcome in Chambéry, which was far better than being considered a wit by her, and a serpent by everybody else. Be that as it may, Mamma saw that, in order to rescue me from the perils of my youth, she must treat me as a man, which she immediately proceeded to do, but in the most singular manner that ever occurred to a woman in similar circumstances. I found her manner more serious, and her utterances more moral than usual. The playful gaiety, which was usually mingled with her advice, was all at once succeeded by a sustained gravity, neither familiar nor severe, which seemed to pave the way for an explanation. After having in vain asked myself the reason of this change, I asked her, which was just what she expected. She proposed a walk in the little garden on the following day. The next morning found us there. She had taken precautions that we should be left undisturbed all day, and employed the time in preparing me for the kindness which she wished to show me, not as another woman would have done by artifices and coquetry, but by language full of feeling and good sense, better calculated to instruct than to seduce me, which appealed rather to my heart than my senses. But, however admirable and useful the words she addressed to me may have been, although they were anything but cold and mournful, I did not listen to them with all the attention they deserved, and did not impress them on my memory, as I should have done at any other time. The manner in which she began, the appearance of careful preparation, had disquieted me. While she was speaking, I was dreamy and distracted, thinking less of what she was saying than of what she wanted. And as soon as I understood, which was by no means easy, the novelty of the idea, which had never once entered my head all the time I'd been living with her, it so completely took possession of me that I was no longer in a state to pay attention to what she said to me. I only thought of her, and did not listen to her. Most instructors are liable to the perverse idea, which I have not avoided myself in my Émile, of making young people attentive to that which they desire to impress upon them, by revealing to them the prospect of something in the highest degree attractive. Struck by the object held before him, a young man devotes his attention to that exclusively, and, leaping lightly over your introductory discourses, makes straight for the goal towards which you are leading him too slowly for his liking. If it be desired to make him attentive, he must not be allowed to go too far ahead. And it was just in this particular that Mamma showed her want of judgment. With characteristic singularity, which accorded with her systematic mind, she took the superfluous precaution of attaching conditions. But as soon as I saw their reward, I no longer listened to them, and hastened to agree to everything. I even doubt whether there is a man in the world sufficiently honest and courageous to make a bargain in a similar case, or a woman capable of pardoning him if he ventured to do so. In consequence of the same singularity, she attached to the agreement the most solemn formalities, and gave me 8 days to think over them, which, like a hypocrite, I assured her I did not require. For, to crown the singularity of the whole affair, I was really glad of the respite, so greatly had the novelty of these ideas struck me, and so disordered did I feel the state of my own to be, that I wanted time to set them in order. It will be imagined that those 8 days seemed 8 centuries to me. On the contrary, I could have wished that they had really lasted as long. I do not know how to describe my condition. It was a kind of fright, mingled with impatience, during which I was so afraid of what I longed for, that I sometimes seriously endeavoured to think of some decent way of avoiding the promised happiness. Consider my ardent and lascivious temperament, my heated blood, my heart intoxicated with love, my vigorous health, my age. Remember that in this condition, thirsting after women, I had never yet touched one. That imagination, need, vanity, and curiosity all combined to devour me with the burning desire of being a man and showing myself one. Add to this, above all, for it must never be forgotten, that my tender and lively attachment to her, far from diminishing, had only become warmer every day, that I was never happy except with her, that I never left her except to think of her, that my heart was full not only of her goodness and amiability, but of her sex, her form, her person. In a word, of her, under every aspect in which she could be dear to me. Do not imagine that, because she was 10 or 12 years older than myself, she had either grown old or appeared so to me. During the 5 or 6 years since the first sight of her had so enchanted me, she had really altered very little, and in my eyes not at all. She had always appeared charming to me, and at that time everyone still considered her so. Her figure alone had become a little stouter. In other respects it was the same eye, the same complexion, the same bosom, the same features, the same beautiful fair hair, the same cheerfulness, even the voice was the same, the silvery voice of youth, which always made so deep an impression upon me that even now I cannot hear without emotion the tones of a pretty girlish voice. What I had to fear in the expectation of possessing one who was so dear to me was naturally the anticipation of it, and the inability to control my desires and imagination sufficiently to remain master of myself. It will be seen that, at an advanced age, the mere idea of certain trifling favours which awaited me in the company of the person I loved heated my blood to such a degree that it was impossible for me to make with impunity the short journey which separated me from her. How then was it that, in the flower of my youth, I felt so little eagerness for the first enjoyment? How was it that I could see the hour approach with more pain than pleasure? How was it that, instead of the rapture which should have intoxicated me, I almost felt repugnance and fear? There is no doubt that, if I had been able to escape my happiness with decency, I should have done so with all my heart. I have promised singularities in the history of my attachment to her. This is surely one which would never have been expected. The reader, already disgusted, is doubtless of opinion that, being already possessed by another man, she degraded herself in my eyes by distributing her favours, and that a feeling of disesteem cooled those with which she had inspired me. He is mistaken. This distribution was certainly very painful to me, as much in consequence of a very natural feeling of delicacy, as because I really considered it unworthy of her and myself. But it never altered my feelings towards her, and I can swear that I never loved her more tenderly than when I had so little desire to possess her. I knew too well her modest heart and her cold temperament to think for a moment that sensual pleasure had anything to do with this abandonment of herself. I was perfectly convinced that nothing but anxiety to save me from dangers that were otherwise almost inevitable, and to preserve me entirely for myself and my duties, caused her to violate a duty which she did not regard in the same light as other women, as will be shown later. I pitied her and pitied myself. I should have liked to say to her, "No, Mamma, it is not necessary. I will answer for myself without that." But I did not dare to do so, first because it was not a thing to say, and in the second place because in the main I felt that it was not true, and that in reality there was only one woman who could protect me against other women and secure me against temptations. Without desiring to possess her, I was very glad that she prevented me from desiring the possession of other women. To such an extent did I look upon everything as a misfortune which would draw me away from her. Our long-continued and innocent intercourse, far from weakening my feelings for her, had strengthened them, but at the same time had given them a different turn, which made them more affectionate, more tender, perhaps, but also less sensual. Having so long called her Mamma, having enjoyed with her the intimacy of a son, I had become accustomed to look upon myself as one. I believe that this was really the cause of the little eagerness I felt to possess her, although she was so dear to me. I well remember that my early feelings, without being livelier, were more sensual. At Annecy I was intoxicated. At Chambéry I was no longer so. I still loved her as passionately as possible. But I loved her more for her own sake than for my own, or at least I sought happiness with her rather than enjoyment. She was for me more than a sister, more than a mother, more than a friend, even more than a mistress. And for that very reason she was not a mistress for me. In short, I loved her too well to desire to possess her. That is most clearly prominent in my ideas. The day, more dreaded than wished for, at length arrived. I promised everything and kept my word. My heart sealed all my vows without desiring their reward. However, I obtained it. For the first time I found myself in the arms of a woman whom I adored. Was I happy? No, I tasted pleasure. A certain unconquerable feeling of melancholy poisoned its charm. I felt as if I had been guilty of incest. Two or three times, while pressing her in ecstasy to my arms, I wetted her bosom with my tears. She, on the other hand, was neither sad nor excited. She was tender and calm. As she was by no means sensual and had not looked for enjoyment, she felt no gratification and never experienced remorse. I repeat it, all her faults were due to her errors, none to her passions. She was well born, her heart was pure, she loved propriety. Her inclinations were upright and virtuous, her taste was refined. She was formed for an elegance of manners which she always loved but never followed, because, instead of listening to her heart, which always guided her aright, she listened to her reason, which guided her wrongly. For when the latter is led astray by false principles, these are always belied by its real feelings. But unfortunately, she rather prided herself on her philosophy, and the morals which she drew from it corrupted those which her heart dictated. Monsieur de Tavel, her first lover, was her instructor in philosophy, and the principles which he taught her were those which he found necessary in order to seduce her. Finding her attached to her husband, devoted to her duties, always cold, calculating, and inaccessible to sensual feelings, he endeavoured to reach her by sophistries, and succeeded in convincing her that the duties to which she was so attached were so much catechism nonsense, intended solely for the amusement of children, that the union of the sexes was in itself a matter of the greatest indifference, that conjugal fidelity was merely an apparent obligation, the inner morality of which only had reference to public opinion, that the husband's repose was the only rule of duty which the wife need respect, so that secret acts of unfaithfulness, being nothing to him against whom they were committed, were equally nothing to the conscience. In short, he persuaded her that the thing was nothing in itself, that only scandal called it into existence, and that every woman who appeared virtuous owed it to that alone. In this manner the wretch attained his object, by corrupting the mind of a child whose heart he had been unable to corrupt. He was punished for it by an all-devouring jealousy, being convinced that she treated him as he had persuaded her to treat her husband. I do not know whether he was mistaken in this. The minister Perret was supposed to have been his successor. All I know is that the cold temperament of this young woman, which ought to have protected her against this system, was just what subsequently prevented her from abandoning it. She could not conceive that anyone should attach such importance to that which possessed no importance for her. She never honoured by the name of virtue an abstinence which cost her so little. She hardly ever misused these false principles for her own sake, but she misused them for the sake of others, and that in consequence of another maxim almost equally false, but more in harmony with the goodness of her heart. She always believed that nothing attached a man so strongly to a woman as possession, and although her love for her friends was only friendship, it was a friendship so tender that she employed all possible means at her disposal to attach them more strongly to her. The remarkable thing is that she nearly always succeeded. She was so truly amiable that the greater the intimacy in which one lived with her, the more one found fresh reasons for loving her. Another thing worthy of notice is that, after her first weakness, she rarely bestowed her favours except upon the unfortunate. Persons of distinction spent their labour upon her in vain. But, if she once began to feel sympathy for a man, he must have been little deserving of love if she did not end by loving him. If she sometimes chose those who were unworthy of her, the blame rested not on any low inclinations, which were far removed from her noble heart, but only on her too generous, too kindly, too compassionate, and too feeling disposition, which she did not always control with sufficient judgment. If some false principles led her astray, how many admirable ones did she possess to which she always remained constant? By how many virtues did she make up for her weaknesses, if those errors can be so called, with which the senses had so little to do? The same man who deceived her in one point instructed her admirably in 1,000 others. And, as her passions were not so unruly as to prevent her from following her reason, she took the right path when her sophisms did not mislead her. Her motives, even in her errors, were praiseworthy. Owing to her mistaken ideas, she might do wrong, but she was incapable of doing so wilfully. She abhorred duplicity and lying. She was just, fair, humane, disinterested, faithful to her word, her friends, and the duties which she regarded as such. Incapable of revenge or hatred, without the least idea that there was any merit in forgiveness. Finally, to return to those qualities which less admit of excuse, without knowing how to estimate the value of her favours, she never made a common trade of them. She was lavish of them, but she never sold them, although she was always at her wit's end how to live. And I venture to assert that if Socrates could esteem Aspasia, he would have respected Madame de Varennes. I know beforehand that when I ascribe to her a sensitive disposition and a cold temperament, I shall, as usual, be accused of contradiction, and with as much reason. It may be that nature was wrong, and that this combination ought not to have existed. I only know that it did exist. All who have known Madame de Varennes, many of whom are still alive, knew well that this was the case. I will even venture to add that she never knew but one real pleasure in life, to procure enjoyment for those whom she loved. Anyone is at liberty to judge of that as he pleases, and learnedly prove that it is not true. My duty is to state the truth, not to make people believe it. By degrees, I became acquainted with all I have just said in the course of the conversations which succeeded our union, and which alone rendered it delightful. She had been right in hoping that her complaisance would be useful to me. I derived great advantages from it as regards my instruction. Hitherto she had only spoken to me of myself alone, as if she had been talking to a child. She now began to treat me as a man, and spoke to me of herself. All that she said to me was so interesting, and I felt so touched by it, that when I reflected, I derived greater advantages from these confidences than from her instructions. When we truly feel that the heart speaks, our own opens to receive its confidences, and all the morality of a pedagogue will never be worth the tender and loving chatter of a clever woman who has gained our affection. The intimate terms on which I lived with her afforded her the opportunity of forming a more favourable estimate of me than before. She was of opinion that, in spite of awkward manner, I was worth being trained for the world, and that if I one day appeared on a certain footing, I should be in a position to make my way. With this idea, she devoted herself not only to forming my judgment, but also my appearance and manners, in order to make me amiable as well as estimable. And if it is true that worldly success is compatible with virtue, which for my part I do not believe, I am at least convinced that there is no other way to such an end than that which she had taken and wished to teach me. For Madame de Varennes understood mankind, and understood in a high degree the art of dealing with them without falsehood and without indiscretion, without deceiving or offending them. But she taught this art rather by her character than by her lessons. She knew better how to practice than explain it, and I was, of all men in the world, the least capable of learning it. Thus, her efforts in this direction were nearly all labour lost, as well as the trouble she took to provide me with fencing and dancing masters. Although supple and of a good figure, I could never learn to dance a minuet. Owing to my corns, I had contracted the habit of walking on my heels, of which Roche could never cure me. And in spite of my active appearance, I have never been able to jump an ordinary ditch. It was worse at the fencing school. After 3 months' instruction, I was still obliged to confine myself to parrying, without being able to deliver an attack. My wrist was not supple enough, or my arm sufficiently firm, to hold my foil, whenever my master chose to make it fly out of my hand. In addition to this, I had a mortal aversion to this exercise, and to the master who attempted to teach me. I could never have believed that a man could be so proud of being able to kill another. In order to bring his commanding genius within my reach, he always explained himself by comparisons drawn from music, about which he knew nothing. He discovered striking analogies between a thrust in tierce and quarte, and the musical intervals of the same name. When he intended to make a feint, he told me to look out for a dièse, because a dièse was formerly called a feint. A dièse in music is a sharp. When he'd knocked the foil out of my hand, he used to say, with a grin, that it was a pause. In short, I have never in my life beheld a more insufferable pedant than this wretched fellow with his plumes and his leather stomacher. I consequently made little progress in these exercises, which I soon gave up from sheer disgust, but I succeeded far better in a more useful art, that of being content with my lot and not desiring one more brilliant, for which I began to feel that I was not born. Entirely devoted to the desire of making Mamma's life happy, I always felt greater pleasure in her company, and when I was obliged to leave her and hurry into the town, in spite of my passion for music, I began to feel the restraint imposed upon me by my lessons. I do not know whether Claude Anet was aware of the intimacy of our relations. I have reason to believe that it did not escape his notice. He was very quick-witted, but very discreet. He never said what he did not think, but he did not always say what he thought. Without giving me the least hint that he knew about it, he seemed to show by his conduct that he did. This conduct was certainly not due to any lowness of disposition, but to the fact that, having adopted his mistress's principles, he could not disapprove if she acted in accordance with them. Although no older than she was, he was so mature and serious that he looked upon us almost as two children who deserved to be indulged, and both of us regarded him as a man worthy of respect, whose esteem we had to conciliate. It was not until she had been unfaithful to him that I understood the extent of the attachment that she felt for him, since she knew that I only felt, thought, and breathed through her. She showed me how much she loved him, in order that I might feel the same affection for him. And she laid stress upon her friendship than upon her esteem for him, since this was a feeling which I was capable of sharing most fully. How often did she move our hearts and make us embrace with tears, at the same time telling us that we were both necessary to her happiness in life. Let not those women who read this laugh maliciously. With her peculiar temperament, there was nothing suspicious about this necessity. It was solely the necessity of her heart. Thus, a companionship was established between us, of which there is perhaps no other example upon earth. All our wishes, cares, and inclinations were in common. None of them went beyond our little circle. The habit of living together, to the exclusion of the rest of the world, became so strong that if, during the course of our meals, one of the three was absent, or a fourth came in, everything was upset, and in spite of our special bonds of attachments, our tête-à-têtes were not so sweet as our party of three. What prevented all restraint between us was an extreme mutual confidence, and what prevented weariness was the fact that we were all constantly employed. Mamma, always planning and always active, allowed neither of us to be idle, and besides, we each of us had enough to do on our own account to keep our time fully occupied. In my opinion, want of occupation is